Okay. So this is our last meeting. We've been doing this all year long. Most of you have been with us all year long. Some of you have been with us longer. And I suppose the question arises, so we graduate, now what? So we'll try to address that toward the end of the phone call. There isn't anywhere else to go, as you know, but there is a different kind of knowing and experiencing to activate. And that's one of the points that gets made at the very end of this chapter, that we need a new experiencer. We have to give up that job, I guess you could say. We have to retire from the job of being the experiencer. So we'll see. We'll talk a little about what that means. Let me say a little bit about the retreat that's coming up. Several of you are going to be on it. Just so you know, we are going to continue with our exploration of time on the retreat. And we will mostly be working with material from Dynamics of Time and Space. So if you want to go ahead and look, let's see if I can find it here. We're going to work with chapters 29 and 30 of Dynamics, which are about time. They're in part 4 of the book, and they include exercises. We'll work with a number of those exercises, and we'll work with a little other material as well. There are going to be people on the retreat who have not been in this program, so it's not as though it's just going to be a continuation of this program, but everybody who is going to be on the retreat who's been in the program will find some familiar themes, I'm sure. So the beginning of the reading, this final reading, introduces a vision, as he says, a vision of time's active engagement. And that vision is of a nameless arising, waves of energy propagating through a field. So I think it's worth pointing out that there are, just in the last two chapters, this chapter and the one before it, Rinpoche has introduced three different images of how time operates, it's interesting to think about why that might be. So he's talked about nuclear time, and then he talked about another image, which I don't think he gave a name to, that was kind of concentric time, past, present, and future, nested within each other. And now he's talking about waves in the field. So why is that? one reason, I think, is Rinpoche is always very careful in the TSK books to make it clear that he's not trying to replace one model with another. So it's not as though we say, oh, now we understand we're going to apply the model of nuclear time, or we're going to apply the model of waves in a field. There are always different ways of looking at time. And so part of the purpose, I think, of introducing different visions, different images, is to make sure that we stay kind of loose and open in our relationship to what Rinpoche is presenting. More specifically, if you look at those three images, I think you could say that what Rinpoche is doing in each of these images is offering a different way of challenging our usual understanding of linear time, the way that time unfolds from past to present to future, through one point of time followed by another point of time, followed by another point of time, and so on, out to infinity as far as we know. That model, that linear time model, that's the one that we have. You know, that's the one that we accept and operate with. And, you know, I can guarantee you that when this course is over, we will continue to apply that model. What we would like is if we could learn to think of that model as a particular model, as a tool. And we'll talk a little more about that, this image that was introduced earlier in the program about linearity being, you know, showing up alongside whatever the particular experiences or events that happen in time. All of that is just standard. You know, all of that is the way that we see time, and it's a perfectly good model. It's interesting that it's not a model, even in our way of thinking, it's not a model that works for everything. It doesn't work for physics, for instance, in quite the way we think. But it's the model we use, and it's the model we can work with. But if we accept that it's the truth of the matter, it's going to be limiting. I think that's all very clear. We've talked about that a lot. So we want to be able to have ways of challenging, questioning the usual understanding of time. And Sorumpsha has been, you know, introduced the nuclear time model. He introduced the nested time model. Here he's introducing a model which is even, you could say, more open, more free of our usual structures, which is this wave field model in which nothing is specified. It's not as though we have past, present, and future and they're nested or they all come together in linear time. They're just not even specified. So it's a different model. I couldn't help when I was reading this of thinking of an article I read recently in Scientific American, and I actually want to share just a little tiny bit of it with you. It's in the current issue of Scientific American, and it's about the nature of reality. It's a philosopher of science writing about this. And he says that there's a view in physics now, I don't think it's the majority view, which says, okay, so you've got it. Most people know there's a particle theory of matter, of what's real. It's all these different little particles like atoms. And then some people say, no, that's not right. There's a wave theory. But those are both based on the idea of something being real. And then the wave theory leads you to an idea that what's actually real is fields. So this starts to get much closer to what Rinpoche is saying here, waves of energy propagating through a field. That would be, I think, an acceptable description of a certain understanding of the nature of reality in physics, or a certain aspect. But then in this article, the author says, but you know, there are problems with that view too. And so there are some people, I'm going to read you just the little blurb in they always give a kind of a executive summary of the article in Scientific American. And it says, if neither particles nor fields are fundamental, then what is? Some researchers think that the world at root does not consist of material things, but of relations or of properties. And then he gives examples that don't interest us. So the idea that you know, there really isn't anything that you can point to. And that comes close, it seems to me, to what Rinpoche says here when he says, nothing is specified, not energy, not field, not arising. I don't bring that up because, you know, I'm thinking that science validates what TSK says, but just because it's helpful sometimes to realize that what we think of as our usual model is open to a lot of problems. And that's really the point that, is being presented here, that we don't, we can't really work with just a single model. And so we might as well be open to explore different models. And when we do that, then that helps loosen our commitment to the ordinary model. I think that's the main thing, the main point that we want to look at. Now, in the reading for last week, there was this nice paragraph which I called your attention to. It's at the top, the first full paragraph on page 164. And Rinpoche says, and I'm going to read it. I'm going to read the whole thing because it really is helpful. For each apparent mechanism that unfolds in time, there is a fitting knowledge. So those mechanisms would include the notion of past, present, and future. So for each apparent mechanism, there is a fitting knowledge. Then what is the knowledge suitable to the body of time? When he says body of time here, he's pointing toward something that goes beyond any model, that goes toward the active aliveness, dynamic, and dimension of time, right? Maybe if you wanted to talk in terms of the first TSK book, maybe you could say the body of time is great time. I'm not sure about that, but I think maybe you could say that. Anyway, he wants to say, what is the knowledge suitable to the body of time? And he says, since nothing is established, knowledge cannot inquire into lineage. So we're not going to look toward the past. Since nothing develops, it cannot trace the processes that have brought us to this present moment or the future that is yet to unfold. It cannot link to concepts, properties, and distinctions, all of which are products of the lower level mechanisms in operation. So we're interested in developing a knowledge that is not bound in all those ways, a knowledge that is fitting for the body of time. And where that leads us in terms of this chapter is the idea that I already mentioned, that in the end, it's not going to be our knowledge. And most of you know, I one of my favorite lines in all the TSK books is from Love of Knowledge, where Rinpoche says, knowledge is not what the knower knows. So we're committed to the idea that we're the ones who know, that we're the knowers who know. And the TSK vision is always pointing us toward the possibility that there's a knowledge that is not owned by the knower. And so the knowledge that's fitting to time, to the body of time, is going to be a knowledge that doesn't belong to us as the knower. And so when Rinpoche talks at the end of this chapter, at the end of this whole section on time, about needing a new experiencer, that takes us in the same direction. So, I think it's fair to say that this vision that he presents here about a nameless arising, you know, there is nothing to be named, and that means there is nothing to be known in the usual sense. And of course, that takes us back toward letting go of the usual structures or accepting them in a different, lighter, more playful way. So I thought we could actually practice with that. The practice is really the same as the one that we've done several times in the program. The idea here is to let experience arise. And that means, you know, you can be looking around the room or wherever you are, you can be letting the stream of thoughts and images arise or sensations, all the different possibilities that constitute, you might say, our usual range of experiences. So you let them all arise and be aware of how much and to what extent they refer to a past and refer to a future. Or in terms of this passage we just read, they refer to something that developed, they refer to a lineage, they refer to something that we anticipate unfolding. So those are our ordinary structures. So we ordinarily place things in terms of past, and future, and then also in terms of present. So what we want to do now as a practice, and we'll do it for about 4 or 5 minutes, what we want to do as a practice is to be aware as experience, well, let's see, as content that's related to the past, as that arises, be aware of the pastness quality of it. Just, you know, let its pastness be there as a part of the experience. Or if it's related to the future, let that be there. Or if it's related to the present, let that sense of nowness. So there may be a quality of not now with the special flavor of the past, or there may be a quality of not now with the special flavor of the future, or there may be a quality of now with the special flavor of the present. Rinpoche says some things about that, but we won't go into it in any details. Just the idea of letting the quality of pastness or futureness or nowness, presentness, letting those be there alongside, and we've used that concept before, alongside the content of what we're experiencing. Is that clear? Any questions? Well, it's clear. Okay. Good. That's because we all have been thinking about this and practicing with it for a long time. It wouldn't be clear to everybody. And we'll see how it works out in practice. Okay. So we'll take a few minutes now to look at those qualities in our experience. Okay, so let's come back together, and as always, I invite you to share your experience. David is already has something to share. That's great. So David writes, looking at a scene in front of you, I suppose, I notice it's a familiar one. It draws connections with fond memories of this location and good feelings welling up now, with a tinge of the old feelings of comfort and love of color, line, and form. Field and grass, branches and leaves relate inwardly to both past and present, both allowing, and gratefulness I am in this moment. So that raises an interesting point, one that I was kind of exploring as we were practicing, and that is this relationship between the present and either past or future. It seems as though whenever we go into the past or the future, we kind of stay anchored in the present. So there are some practices in the first TSK book that challenge that, but that's our usual approach. It seems as though part of the past and the future is that they relate back. They relate back to this present moment. And I think it's partly for that reason that we think of the present as being more real. I don't know that you know what. One of the questions it's always useful to ask in terms of exploring the TSK vision is, what is our witness? You know, we've looked at the idea of the witness before in this program. What is our witness or our guarantor of reality? And maybe it has to do with this idea that this experience that we stay connected in to the present, even when the past or the future is the focus of our content. And perhaps that, perhaps the way to explore that particular possibility more would be in terms of the vision, the image of nested times, of three times that are nested in one another. So that's a possibility. Those are the kinds of things, of course, that it's useful to explore. Okay, I'm not seeing anything else written, so sure. Go ahead, Michael. Right. I think it's a good point. I'm going to summarize it because, as you know, one of the limitations on the recordings that we do here is, for some reason, I've never understood it, the comments that people make don't get recorded. So I'm going to repeat it. Basically, I'm of course, I have to shorten it a little. you're saying that if we respond to the past with appreciation or similar feelings, then we welcome that memory. And in the same way, if we respond to the future, the kind of challenge of action, with a sense of competence and ability to act, then we have positive feelings toward that. But it can also be the other way around, that we respond with regret or remorse or anxiety or concern. Those are the ones that we don't like. You know, what I think is very helpful there is your comment helps us see that it's really so limiting to think in terms of these little points of time. You know, here we are, the present moment is somehow related to the past and somehow related to the future, and that in itself is problematic. But, you know, the points are never big enough to hold this very complicated structure that you're presenting. We're always reacting and engaging and labeling and responding. That's what our reality consists of. And you know, the future and the past fit in to, you know, what you might call our self-image or our story that we tell about ourselves or a sense of who we are. It may be, and maybe these two points, you know, your point and the point that I was reflecting on with David's comment, maybe they're related. It may be that the real place to challenge our usual linear model of time is right there in the present, because we have ways of engaging the past and ways of engaging the future, but they're all based on our own sense of who we are right now. But that's also just a moment in time. So that would be a place to look. I think that's right. We talked before about the witness, and we talked before about the storyteller. And you know, maybe a more neutral way of saying that would be there is an interpretation that goes on. And part of the interpretation is that we assign it to the present. You know, we assign it to the one in the present who's doing the interpretation. And, you know, sometimes it helps to recast things and not do it so much in terms of the usual structure of the self that's doing something. So we've looked at that a lot. But yeah, it seems as though in any event, however we think about it, at some point, interpretation enters into the picture. There's no room for that in the past, present, future structure, but it's very obvious when we just look at our own experience. Okay, Sudhi has a comment here. There are moments and experiences that do not have a sense of any specific time. When I am engaged fully, that timeless sense shows up. Yeah, I think that's well worth exploring. It's related to the idea that linear time is a mechanism, you know, that the particular components of it, of past, present, and future, are parts of that mechanism that make the whole thing work. But it may be that sometimes we don't need that mechanism. It may be that sometimes it doesn't make any sense. So perhaps when we're engaged fully, you know, it may be that before we have past and present and future, we need to have a story. We need to be telling a story. When we're engaged, you know, we're not telling a story. We're not already commenting on what's going on. There's just the going on of what's going on. Okay, well, let's move on with this a little. There's a lot in this chapter, and I really feel there's a lot in every chapter, but I really feel committed to going through it. However, I see that Karen says there seem to be different levels of pastness quality. That's probably true. I mean, I'm sure that's true. And I don't know exactly what you have in mind. So if you want to say something, you know, give a couple of examples. Maybe you could, either live or you could write something in the chat box. And if so, I'll come back to it. I'll go on right now. We've So, okay, I'm going to skip over a little bit, but the point that I want to move on to, and then we'll bring it in, we'll connect it up to the issue of the light bridge that Rinpoche ends this whole section with. The point that I want to move on to is creativity. So at the bottom of page 165, Rinpoche is talking about how within linear time, and we really were trying to do a practice that stayed within the structures of linear time, within linear time, we can open to the freedom of the bottom body of time, because we can look through time, and you could take the exercise we did as an exercise in trying to look through time and see how that is. And then he says, the less we insist, this is the last paragraph on 165, the less we insist, the closer we draw to the invisible energy of the body of time, the creative impulse through which appearance itself manifests. That creative impulse, that's what I'd like to work with. Or at least look at as we close our session, as we move toward the end of now. The creative impulse that time allows, it seems to me that that's a really good place to connect in to the aliveness of time. And that, as much as anything else, is what we would like to take out of this whole exploration of time that we've been doing. That if we can engage time with a different vision of what time is, and Rinpoche has given us all these different alternatives, if we can engage time with a different vision of what is, then we come closer to touching the aliveness of time. And if we want a way into that, it has to do with this creative impulse. So in that connection, there's a really nice image. I'll get to it in a moment. I see another question by Sudhi. She says, if time is an imposed structure, without that imposed structure, then what does the body of time mean? Well, very, very fundamental question, really important, I think. The body of time is not a structure, that's clear. If anything, I'm not going to try to answer it exactly, because you can read through and see what the chapter says about the body of time. But the idea of the body of time is that it's this aliveness. The body of time is not a body in our usual sense, that has a particular location and particular shape and so on. It's more the aliveness of time. And it gets placed into certain constructs. So that paragraph we were just looking at actually talks about that. It says, the body of time remains undisturbed by our propensities toward structure. We structure things. We structure the body of time. You might, although this is not exactly, it's a little bit misleading, this image, but you might think of the body of time as something that we can sculpt like clay, so that it can take any possible shape or form. What's misleading about that is that even when clay is just sitting there as an unformed lump, it still has a presence or a structure or a place or a location or weight. The body of time doesn't have any of that. Those are all part of the structures that we impose. So I think the answer to your question is that the body of time means something different from any structure. It allows all structures, like space. Space allows all form. Okay. Michael writes, it's interesting that the creative impulse is not an individual's creativity, but a kind of pulse into which an individual can come into relationship. And Sudhi comments, I think, on that. It seems then the creativity connects to it, connects to the body of time, I guess you're saying, Sudhi. Yes, I think the creativity connects, is a way of connecting to the body of time. Rinpoche gives a couple of possibilities, and this is the one we're focusing on. Yeah, I think it's absolutely right, Michael's comment, that the creative impulse doesn't belong to anybody. And that's actually not so surprising. You know, our usual model of creativity, of course, we do have this model that we don't think about too much when we talk about a particular person as being very creative, and that makes it sound like it's a property of that person. But we have a very different model where we think about creativity as something that we tune into or tap into. And I think that's a little closer to what's being said here. And even if we talk about something as simple as thinking, you know, sometimes we say, I think such and such. And so then that's something that the self is doing. But we also sometimes say, I just had a thought. And when we say that, it leaves open the question of, well, where did this thought that you had come from? Right? It occurred to you. We say, it occurs to me that, right? So it comes from somewhere else. And that somewhere else, I think, is very much related to this creative impulse that doesn't belong to any individual. I want to look briefly at a passage on 166, and then we can talk for a couple of minutes about the light bridge. There's the whole discussion on at the bottom of 166, I think, is very beautiful. And it talks about how our reality is constructed. Let me read just at least a part of it. Talking about the field communique, it says appropriate mechanisms arise. The field affirms its own modality. It shapes form and content. A language is generated, and that founds the genealogy of what appears, the genes that give form to specification. So I'm not going to go into the details of that. It's too much to do that. But the point I want to make is that that's a kind of a creation myth. He's really saying, how does reality arise, right? Our usual reality. At the top of 167, he says something that he said in many ways and in other places in this book. He says, there's a seamless instigation. Everything comes together. Everything fits. And he refers to it as a multiple creation, right? So it's a kind of a creation myth, and I just want to use that term because I want to play with it a little bit, because you could say the myth in this creation myth is that something has been created. We accept the truth of what's put in place, and that's a myth. It doesn't mean that it's false. It just means that it's a story that we're telling. A particular form that creativity takes on. It's not that nothing is created. It's that the thingness of what's created is part of the myth, right? The creation myth is that something is created. It makes much more sense to look at this in terms of a sourceless arising. That's the body of time again. Because the body of time is not really a source, and yet it's the aliveness that makes that creativity possible. And so it's when we tune into that, and again on 168, he talks about this. He says, let's see if I can find it. At the very top, he says, there's an inward conducting, and we've certainly talked about that before. There's projecting before projection. There's this aliveness, right? And he says, in this persistence of the possible, the boundlessly creative presents. So what we would like to, in a sense, take away from the TSK vision with respect to time is this persistence of the possible. which is the presentation of boundless creativity. In other words, we don't have to accept the given, as something that was done once and for all. The possible always persists, and the arising of the ordinary, the arising of what we take for granted, is just one manifestation, one recording of this, of the possible. It's the one we accept. And ordinarily we accept it and we accept it and we accept it from moment to moment to moment. Because we accept it, we don't see it as even something to be accepted. We just think it's the way things are. When we recognize that there's an ongoing creation of what appears as so, then the possibility for things being different is there. And that's what Rinpoche says at the very end of the chapter and section. He says, just the last few sentences of the chapter, he says, we need no longer play out the same patterns. Our old patterns, our old ways of being are placed in question. If we wish, if that is our intention, we can change them freely. Now, are we the ones who are doing the changing? No. But, you have to use language the way it is. There is a different changer, just as there is a different experiencer. So let's look at that for a moment, and that'll be our closing. There's this whole new image that Rinpoche introduces and that I ask people to comment on, the idea that the experiencer can be transformed directly into light. It's a brand new idea, and it's puzzling. Rinpoche himself says, when you hear that, you automatically connect it to some sort of mystical experience or mystery or magical experience. There's all these words that are kind of related to each other, magic and mystery and miracle and mystic. We automatically think, oh, he's talking about something really, really esoteric now. And he tries to deconstruct that. He says, no, light is very obvious, very everyday. There's nothing special about it. So, and let me say that those of you who did post something on the website, I think you all touched on this idea. I think you all went with the idea that, or the experience of light as something that's freely available, but you have to open yourself to it. And one way to do that is to do so lightly. This is this wonderful play that we have available in English. Between the two senses of light, light as the particular energy form that's streaming in all the time, and light as something that's not heavy, something that's kind of easy that we can relax into. So both of those are there. So I want to say a little bit about that. Let's look at a comment by Michael here. He says, is the possible contrasted with the impossible? What is the property that makes something possible? Is there anything alongside the infinitude of the possible? And those are great questions. I'm not going to try to answer them right now. except I'll answer the first one. I don't think that the possible is contrasted with the impossible. I think the moment you're in that realm, you're already in the realm of something that's been structured. So maybe that's a clue toward thinking through the rest of it. They're really good questions. So I'll save the chat and maybe people can look at those questions and reflect on them. So I just want to say one more thing, and then we'll be done. And that is this idea of a light bridge into time. The bridge that Rinpoche starts off with in this section on the light bridge is our usual structures of linear time, right? They're strong and they're rigid, he says. The strong and rigid structures of linear time are the bridge for crossing over to such a possibility. Well, what's the possibility? maybe you could just say it's sheer possibility, but that's pretty much what he says, wholly unlimited, boundless, immeasurable time, the body of time, those kinds of possibilities. He says linear time can be the bridge for crossing over. Now, linear time structures, he says, are strong and rigid. What we want to be able to do is take those strong and rigid structures and turn them into light structures, right? Structures that are light, that we can approach playfully, and structures that are constructs. Maybe that's a good way to say it. And one way to think about this is when we talk about light and we talk about appearance, and just the ordinariness of light, as Rinpoche says, we're talking about sunlight here, nothing special. Whatever appears, and I think this can be generalized out beyond the sense of sight, but it starts with the sense of sight. Whatever appears is just a reflection of light. It's nothing but light, you know, it's the light that is not absorbed by the object. It is reflected back from the object. That's our experience. The whole of visible experience is just light. I mean, that's just a fact, you know. That's not, as he says, not something mystical or mysterious. It's just ordinary. And that's one place to look or one place to think about this. Right? Whatever appears is light appearance. And although the word appearance does relate to the sense of sight, I think you could generalize that. Whatever you hear is sound appearance, you know? And whatever you think, whatever the content of your thoughts are, that's thought appearance, and so on and so forth. And what we do is turn that into something that's solid or strong and rigid, and we do that by naming, we do that by proclaiming, we do that by setting up the mechanics of what appears. We're turning away. So at the end of the chapter here, Rinpoche talks about silent light. Right? He says, this is the third full paragraph on that page, 169. He says, through light, we can reach the other side of time. The other side here seems to me related to the idea of, you know, the body of time. In the present presence of light, the bridge to presentness opens. I hope that's clear. I mean, in the way it should be clear, even though it's one of Rinpoche's typical sentences that you have to kind of reflect on. But we've said enough about it. In the present presence of light, the bridge to presentness opens. But then he says, as the voices of our naming fall still, a silent light leads towards silent time. And so you might say, well, light is always silent. It has nothing to do with sound. But he's making a different point here, and I think he makes it very clearly. Light returns to silence when we stop naming. He says, as the voices of our naming fall still, a silent light leads us towards silent time. So we would like for the voices of our naming to stop, to fall still. It doesn't mean that it's not the stillness of being mute. It's not the stillness of being unable to speak or refusing to speak. It's the stillness that you find within whatever we name, within whatever structure we occupy. And that's something we can explore with. That's something we can continue to investigate as we go on. Okay, I'm going to stop there. We are definitely out of time. As I've mentioned before, we'll go on in September, and the structure will be very different because we'll be starting a review that's more of an overview of the whole time-space knowledge vision that will be going on for some time. So thank you very much, everybody. It's always very illuminating for me to think through all these things with you. I always learn so much, and of course, we all need to thank Rinpoche for making this vision available. So, That's it. You'll be hearing from us soon, and I'll see some of you on the retreat. Goodbye.